This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special full-hour program with whistleblower icon Daniel Ellsberg. He's noted for releasing the Pentagon Papers.
He was tried under the Espionage Act, the same act that's being used against Julian Assange. But Ellsberg wasn't a journalist. The Assange prosecution is a first.
We'll also discuss Ellsberg's latest book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear Planner.
There are two swords hanging over humanity, ecocidal climate change and the threat of nuclear war. Daniel Ellsberg was a nuclear planner and knows quite a lot about that threat.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration announced it had indicted Julian Assange in the Eastern District of Virginia on 17 counts of violating the 1917 Espionage Act. Assange is currently in the Belmarsh Prison Hospital in London. If extradited, tried, and convicted, he faces 175 years in prison. The Espionage Act is a 102-year-old law used initially to imprison the great socialist Eugene V. Debs for an anti-World War I speech he gave in Canton, Ohio, and also used to crush the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, a large anti-war union at the time. In 1971, it was famously used against Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and other media outlets. Lately, the Espionage Act has been used against many truth-telling whistleblowers during the Obama and Trump administrations. But this is the first time it's being used against a journalist. Here to talk with us today is Daniel Ellsberg, now 88 years old. He was educated at Harvard and Cambridge and has been an activist since the 1970s. Ellsberg's latest book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear Planner, is an extensive study of nuclear theory and policy. We'll spend the second half of the show talking about it. In 2018, Ellsberg was awarded the Olof Palme Prize for his, quote, profound humanism and exceptional moral courage.
Dan Ellsberg, a very hearty welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
What does the Espionage Act outlaw?
The Espionage Act was intended to outlaw espionage, that is, spying, giving information secretly to a foreign power, especially an enemy in time of war. It was passed immediately on our entry into World War I. And by the way, it's often confused, I would say, with a part of it, which was passed a little bit later, which suppressed free speech, particularly in, it was like the Alien and Sedition Acts under Adams. Eugene Debs was jailed under that for advocating draft resistance. And that actually, that part of the law expired a little after the end of the war. So essentially this has been used until my trial in 1971 for spies, and it was used quite a bit for that and still is. However, it does have, well, we don't have an official Secrets Act like Britain and like most other countries that criminalizes all release of government-protected classified data without regard to motive or impact or possible benefits. None of that can be argued in court because the Espionage Act, which is, as I say, intended for spying, is a strict liability law. Motive isn't part of it, just a question, did you do this or not, not why, or was there some public interest in it? That doesn't benefit spies very much. But when it's used against leakers or whistleblowers like me and like a dozen other people, that's a really constraining effect on the prosecution. It really prevents the possibility of a fair trial for a leaker or a whistleblower being generally in the national security field, a type of leaker who does it to reveal a wrongdoing or a crime or a deception, something dangerous. Leaks in general are from agencies of the government intended to improve their budget or their status. or their policy. So they're really authorized by somebody in government, whereas whistleblowers, in all cases I know of, have no authorization from anybody. No one wants the embarrassment of having their information out. So to try people for trying to inform the public of information they ought to know, the Espionage Act is entirely inappropriate and actually unconstitutional. That's never been tested in the Supreme Court. No leaking or whistleblowing case has gone to the Supreme Court. One was referred up to that, the Samuel Loring Morrison case, about 10 years after mine, but the Supreme Court denied certiorari. So they've never really tested whether this act is constitutional, and certainly in this application. And at my time, in the early 70s, it would almost surely have been found unconstitutional. But the practices, the effect of the law has changed over the years, and especially with this new court. I think the reason why Assange has been brought up in this charge now rather than 2 years earlier or 10 years earlier under Obama is that Kavanaugh is in the court and Gorsuch, and the president is counting on a court now that will not worry too much about whether it's constitutional.
So I wanted to ask you what you were charged with and what Julian is charged with, and secondly, are you saying because Julian released video showing American soldiers committing war crimes in Iraq in 2010, are you saying that Julian is not going to be able to say, well, I did it for a good reason, that the only question here is that
absolutely
he did it?
No, he will not. None of the people brought up under the so-called Espionage Act have been able to argue that in military court for Chelsea Manning or civilian court, about a dozen of them. There had never been such a prosecution of anybody in this country, not a non-espionage case, before mine in 1971 to 1973. And there wasn't another for 10 years. And then there was a third under Bush, which was effectively dismissed under Obama. So there had been three. Obama brought nine cases, three times as many as all previous presidents put together. But in not one of those cases was the... most of them were not in front of juries, by the way, because they got guilty. They got plea bargains out of them, threatening much greater sentences. And the lawyers or the clients just didn't have the money or the will to go on with it. And they pled, but so you didn't get an appeal on that. But the couple who had have not been judged so by the Supreme Court. So that is the case. You couldn't, if I revealed classified information on this call. The new thing with Assange is that, and this is the difference from all the earlier ones, including mine, is that it's aimed at a non. At a journalist, not at an official who had signed secrecy agreements and was breaking those agreements deliberately, usually in because they felt that the agreement was concealing a crime or was endangering people. And in this case, for the first time, they are using that act against a journalist. And some are arguing, in fact, the Justice Department is arguing, he's not a real journalist. That is ludicrous. He does journalism. He's recognized by nearly all other journalists as a journalist. Indeed, Bill Keller did raise the question, as he wasn't the kind of journalist that Bill Keller of the New York Times recognized. I think that was a stupid and self-serving notion by Keller, because he didn't want a prosecution of Assange to point toward him as an editor. And there are other journalists probably who will do that. That's one reason Assange is being singled out, I think, for this, that he won't have the unified support of the Fourth Estate here. But any journalist who thinks that a conviction of Julian Assange on these charges doesn't create a perfectly binding precedent for an attack on her or him is very ignorant or naive or disingenuous. The fact is, this is an attack on journalism of a new sort. going after the sources like me is already an attack on journalism and cutting off leaks and revelations, disclosures to the press. Going after the press itself is a new front there and very ominous.
The Obama Justice Department did not charge Julian with espionage, but now he's been charged with that. Does that mean that they could also charge?
None of us have been charged with espionage. These are all cases that were described in my case as a non-espionage charge under, and frankly, there is no official Espionage Act. That's not a term that's used in the U.S. Code. The designation of it is 18 U.S.C. U.S. Code, 793 paragraphs D and E are the paragraphs that are used here. Earlier paragraphs apply only to spies. But these two paragraphs, inexplicably, as people have puzzled about this for half a century, there's really no answer. They put why they put language into that case that can indeed be interpreted as being an official secrets act aimed at non-spying, but just revelation of classified information. In that respect, it's like the British Official Secrets Act, but it's never been used until now against the journalists because the Department of Justice was always afraid that the whole act would be thrown out as unconstitutional, and they wouldn't have anything to threaten people with using. But it wasn't, the language was there to go against me as a source, even though that was very questionably constitutional. And it's just as well been there to be used against a journalist or, this is almost bizarre, against a reader of the New York Times or any other journal that says this is a classified document to which we've been given access. Anybody who reads that is holding in her hands classified information to which she was not entitled. And she could be charged with under that language with holding it, not returning it to the proper authorities. It's a little hard to know just how you do that with a newspaper or who you direct it to. And definitely, if she hands that newspaper to her husband, you know, vice versa, she's distributing it to an unauthorized person. So the language definitely applies to such an act. And people have said all the time, well, don't worry about it. You know, they haven't applied it, which is true. And they won't, which now proves to be untrue. I've been warning people now for 40 years that that language was there to be used against them, journalists and others. And no one's really paid any attention because it hadn't happened. Well, now it's happened.
Well, what you're saying, I think, is that not only could the government go after and is going after Julian, but it could go after the New York Times.
Definitely. And I remember what this president especially focused on the Washington Post as a purveyor of false news. But he says in general, the press, not just the New York Times and Washington Post, not just the mainstream press, not just the, quote, fake news press, which means newspapers that print disparaging comments about Donald J. Trump. He just said the press is the enemy of the people, a Stalinist phrase. And in fact, this whole operation now against journalists is pretty Stalinist.
Yeah, I'll say. In your case, Dan Ellsberg, the government tried to bribe the judge by sending a Nixon aide, John Haldeman, out to California twice, where he met with the judge, your judge, and he offered that judge the directorship of the FBI.
He had, Judge Matthew Byrne had been offered the directorship by John Ehrlichman, counsel to the president, in San Clemente, where Byrne met the president. And then about a week or 10 days later, Byrne requested a second meeting during my trial to discuss the directorship with Ehrlichman, and he met Ehrlichman in Santa Monica. When it came to giving information about the illegal break-in by CIA assets to my doctor's psychoanalyst office, that information was withheld by the president for about 13 days, claiming that it was national security, didn't have to be given to the court. And then when his two highest officials in the Justice Department said they would have to resign because this was an obstruction of justice, to use three words that have been in the air lately, for similar reasons. So he sent the word, not via Haldeman, but actually by General I think it was General Haig who delivered that information to the judge and told him he didn't have to put it out because it was national security stuff, and the judge recognized better than that, of course. And he did put it out, which started the downfall of Nixon.
In Julian Assange's case, it's being brought in the Eastern District of Virginia, and the chief judge in the Eastern District has kept all these national security cases herself, and she's the judge there. And she has refused to allow, on the grounds of national security, the defendants to really put on a fulsome defense. So in this case, I believe that the judge's name is pronounced Brinkema. In any case, Judge Brinkema got all these convictions by really crippling the defense. I'm afraid that Julian won't be able to put on a defense either because the documents he'd like to use, she'll say, are national security, and you can't use them.
Yeah. Well, that would be, you brought that to my attention earlier with a link, and that does seem to be the case. But what I'm saying is that when it comes to being able to plead public interest, Assange would face the same situation with any of the judges who have held these cases or any other judge. The act is just written that way. And the judge actually could accept a lawyer's motion to dismiss the case on the grounds of constitutionality, but none of them have been willing to do that yet, to take that initiative.
How have the corporate media outlets behaved? First, when Julian released the Iraqi war crime tapes back in 2010, and then afterwards, and now, have they changed? What is the big media's position been on all of this?
Since my case back in 73, that's more than half a century, and just about half a century, and they really have never paid attention to the law on this, to my knowledge. I can't remember a single article on my case, and there was an article every day in the Times that mentioned legal aspects of this, or the constitutional aspects of this, and they're just not aware of it. And when I tell journalists about this, and I ask them questions about what they know or didn't know, they're simply not aware of the law because they have never been the target of it. There are no previous cases. The closest to it was the AIPAC case brought under George W. Bush, American Israel Public Affairs Committee, where two lobbyists for Israel, who obviously weren't authorized to get this, did get it from an official who was charged and put in prison. And they got the information, so they were the first people being charged with receiving this, like any reader or journalist. And basically on those grounds, the judge made rulings on his own, essentially, interpreting the act very restrictively, and actually rewriting it to some extent. He read in elements of defense that just aren't there. But in that case, the Obama prosecutors dropped the case because they couldn't win it. So the journalist, James Rosen of Fox News, was described as an unindicted co-conspirator for receiving classified information, as usually happens every day of the week, from somebody. And in this case, not particularly a whistleblower, just somebody who passed on the information with no great intent, public interest in it. He went to prison. But in order to get a wiretap on the journalist's phone, they described him as a co-conspirator, and that meant vulnerable to prosecution, available for prosecution. They didn't prosecute him. So again, the press didn't really wake up on that one. And I just have to say that they were so sure that, with the basis of the First Amendment, that they would be regarded as immune even from that defective wording in the Espionage Act, which had not been applied to them, that I would say the press simply never informed themselves on the subject, and they were not aware, for example, of the unfairness of the trials of these sources. Now, after all, they were their sources. To a layman, they looked like a part of the journalistic process, but the press has never treated them as such. They treat it as though, on the one hand, it's all, the sources have their own motives of various kinds, which journalists don't always respect. And So I think they have an attitude sort of like police toward their snitches. People they think in the national security field are breaking the law, which was really very, is untrue, at least arguably untrue in the U.S. with its First Amendment, that these people are breaking a constitutional law. But the press, I think, regards them as that. So they're lawbreakers. They're criminals, not like us journalists. And the difference is that now the administration is saying, oh, actually, you are criminals, you guys who are receiving it as well. So that, I think, will at last get the attention of some of them. And if Julian is extradited, prosecuted, and convicted, which, as you're pointing out, under Judge Leone Brinkema would be almost certain to be the case, then national security investigative reporting that doesn't simply rely on government handouts. In other words, the foundation of a republic in terms of wars, war and peace, foreign affairs, war crimes, and all that, is gone. You don't have a First Amendment anymore. That's what's at stake here. And, you know, a lot of newspapers wouldn't care about that too much. They'll stay in line, just like papers in China or, Saudi Arabia, I guess. Actually, a lot of countries in the world. And they will rely on the leaks they get from interested parties in the government, agencies that want to downgrade some budget rival in the government by showing that its weapons don't work or are overpriced or something like that. So the press will continue to get plenty of leaks on a classified basis, which means their competitors don't get them. They're not announced in press conferences usually. They're given out as party favors to particular journalists, and then they have a scoop. And somebody else gets a scoop next week, but that's all right. If you are a good boy or girl and don't describe the source and don't mention to your readers the interests, the special interests that led to that leak, which journalists may often know very well. If you serve the purposes of the leakers, the agencies, you'll get others. You'll have your scoop again later. So it's a symbiotic relation with the press, and they've never looked into the secrecy system, which is an extremely abusive system that undermines democracy terribly. And it's as if, in fact, it's exactly as if they're not looking into the behavior of the regulators, regulation agencies, even when, let's say, as right now, Trump is putting in coal lobbyists and energy people in charge of the environment, the proverbial fox in charge of the chicken coop. That does get occasionally revealed, but just enough to validate the press as a watchdog to some extent. But the truth is, there should be enormously more whistleblowing, more leaking and more whistleblowing for many reasons. And the reason there isn't is that the press doesn't really question the secrecy regulations that keep those people in line and make truth-telling fatal to their careers.
We're speaking with Dan Ellsberg. Dan, I know that you visited Julian Assange several times. I wanted to ask you about his health situation, and I wanted to underline that he's in a maximum security prison in the hospital ward at the prison. He's serving 50 weeks for jumping bail, a rather minor offense. And recently, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Metzler, said, "I condemn in the strongest terms the deliberate, concerted, and sustained nature of the abuse inflicted on Julian Assange and earnestly deplore the consistent refusal of all involved governments to take measures for the protection of his human rights and dignity." What is his health situation now?
Well, his, from all I hear, very bad, even critical. It's not, I think, entirely clear what is, at least I haven't heard exactly what the problem is, but it has resulted in extreme loss of weight and being rather incoherent. And by the way, we're talking about somebody who is brilliant and extremely coherent, as I know and have heard him many times. And the lawyers and the rapporteur say they can't carry on a conversation with him now. He's so agitated and anxious. The whether he's getting the MRI on his shoulder, which he's needed for years now with pain in his shoulders, constant, or the dental attention, which has apparently been very severe and which he could not get inside the Ecuadorian embassy because it required, in both cases, required equipment they couldn't bring into the embassy. And the British would never allow him to go to a doctor or hospital from the embassy without being arrested. So he's been years in that situation, essentially without a kind of medical attention that he needed. The first time I saw him, he seemed to be in reasonably good shape under the circumstances and was getting lots of visitors in those days. Then they pretty much shut that off. The second time, we had to almost threaten civil disobedience to get in to see him, but we did get to see him. And he was, that was with John Cusack, by the way, the actor who's a very strong civil liberties activist. And we did see him, but he did not look good. He's naturally fair-haired, virtually fair-skinned, I mean, virtually white-haired. And the lack of sunlight, had, even though he has a sun lamp, so I don't know what the problem is quite there, but he was just white as a sheet and did not look good, generally. So I was not surprised to hear what very bad shape he was in when they brought him out, though that's apparently relatively recently that he's in that bad shape. So that's another reason that actually, I think the rapporteur actually went so far as to say he should not be extradited for health reasons. He'll be treated badly based on the treatment of Chelsea Manning, and by that precedent, he should not be sent to the U.S.
What is the extradition situation there? Is that going to be a long process in England, or can the United States get its hands on him rather quickly? What do you know about that?
The my impression is that it would generally be expected to be very long in terms of appeals. And the question of Swedish role in this. Now, I've just read this morning that the Swedes are proposing to come talk to him, not to bring him over to Sweden, but to talk to him in jail, which might mean there's no charges in the end, or otherwise. They've never brought charges directly. They just said they want to talk to him. They could always have come and talked to him in the Ecuadorian embassy, and finally did, and just before they dropped some of the charges. But they could have done that years ago and were refusing, and they do it with other people. They'd refuse to come and talk to him outside Sweden. My guess is on pressure from the U.S. We know, by the way, on pressure from the British, and that would almost surely reflect, I think, pressure from the Americans on the Swedes not to simply come and interrogate him in person in the jail or by Skype or Zoom or anything like that. So as the rapporteur says, you've got a coalition here of the willing of democratic, otherwise democratic countries, or in some ways democratic countries, the U.S., U.K., Sweden, and for that matter, Ecuador, which is not wonderful in its treatment of the press generally, but which had given Assange asylum. So you have all these people, with the new president of Ecuador added to that, that have been defaming him and calling him a traitor and a hostile intelligence service, and in every way trying to make a case for prosecution and extradition, despite the fact that he is not an American. He's in a foreign country from America. He's a journalist, the main thing here. So, but they're trying to make him into a man who does not have the sympathy of journalists or readers in the world, who will therefore not make a fuss and protest and oppose extraditing them.
Yeah, I want to underscore the point you just made, Dan Ellsberg. This is really an extraterritorial operation by the United States, reaching out and grabbing an Australian citizen in Great Britain. What can our listeners do to get more information on the case, and what can they do to support Julian Assange?
Yes, you know, I wish I had the links right here. If they look up Julian Assange, say, on news, Google News or something, they'll find lots of articles about it, but there are indeed ways to get money to him, his defense, that is, and I don't have it right at my hand here, but it wouldn't take a lot of investigation. Yes, his court cases do require funding from the government, although, from the public, although I believe there's a lot of pro bono work being done for him. It used to be the Michael Ruttner firm, who's dead now. I think the firm is still representing him. Am I right?
Well, Michael was with the Center for Constitutional Rights. So
yeah, I think you should find that out and get it in. That definitely should be in. And do not wait for the New York Times or the Washington or any of the papers that have published his material and even gotten awards for publishing the material. Don't wait for them to mention the fact that he does have a defense fund or the address of it or anything else. The New York Times, and no paper, including the New York Times, ever published in the 2 years I was on trial the fact that I had a defense fund, despite the fact that we asked them to do that.
Yeah, well, when they attempted to shut down WikiLeaks, they tried to close off PayPal and other ways to
funnel money. At that point, I was part of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which was a channel for audience for to send in money through us to WikiLeaks. But now, that was when it was basically closed off by PayPal and Bank of America and various others could not get money to him by reason of threats from our executive branch, actually. But now money can be gotten, and I'm just sorry I don't have the links.
We'll post a link on lawanddisorder.org for our listeners. Dan Ellsberg, has WikiLeaks been effectively closed down now?
I would say not. I'm not aware of it. I believe while he's been in jail, Kristen Craftsman, I can't pronounce the name exactly, and it's like Icelandic name, has been acting as spokesperson for WikiLeaks, and they do publish quite regularly. But anyway, they do have a website and do publish a lot of material, even new. People send them in. So, and until the last year or so, Julian, from his Ecuadorian embassy asylum, was pretty much in charge, I believe, you know, and had pretty good access to computers. But then Ecuador cut that off about a year ago, and he certainly doesn't have it in jail now. Of course, for Julian Assange, like as it would be for Ed Snowden or Chelsea Manning, who are computer nerds, experts, being deprived entirely of computer access is itself a cruel and unusual punishment, and that's not really a joke.
I just want to close this segment of Law and Disorder with a statement from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, who said, in 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, I have never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time and with so little regard for human dignity and the rule of law. And I wanted to close this segment of Law and Disorder, Dan Ellsberg, with your thoughts on what Melzer said.
Well, I'm impressed by it, of course, when he's talking from his experience. I don't know any counterexamples, but I'm not. And I am something of a specialist in this case of whistleblowing in general. I follow it very closely, having been the first one to be prosecuted. But I think he's talking more generally than WikiLeaks and whistleblowing, that it's a ganging up of democratic countries, actually, against just one person, whatever the charge was. And not a classic criminal charge, like murder or something, but rather a very clearly political charge and relating to free speech. So I can well believe his statement that it's unprecedented. By the way, in answer to your question, I just looked up trying to get the WikiLeaks. And I noticed that they have a Revelations today, a set of documents from the Catholic Church that says, shedding light on the power struggle within highest offices. That sounds very timely.
Certainly is. Dan Ellsberg, thank you very much for explicating the Julian Assange situation for our audience. And I wanted to turn now in the time that we have remaining to talk with you about the extremely important book that you published at the end of 2017 called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions, Your Confessions of a Nuclear Planner. The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear Planner. What was your job experience with U.S. nuclear policy?
Well, I spent the summer of 1958 as a summer consultant at the RAND Corporation in the Economics Department, getting a top secret clearance for that. Though most of our work at RAND was at the lower level, secret level. Well, it was only later that I got more into top secret work. But very early on in 59, the end of 59, I went as a full employee. I joined a research study under the Office of Naval Research in the Pacific under Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, Felt, Admiral Felt, studying his command and control, which means his, in particular, his ability to send out an execute order for nuclear weapons, for nuclear war, from Oahu, his headquarters in the Pacific. And the thing that I looked at in particular was the possibility of unauthorized action, or action where neither the president or even Singh Pak had actually sent an authenticated execute order, but nevertheless nuclear weapons were sent off. And what I discovered was that there was a very great scope for that happening throughout the Pacific. There were no locks on the weapons, so and many of them were on carried on alert on operational single pilot planes on alert strips throughout the Pacific, ready to go off in a 10-minute warning to take off and go toward targets. And in theory, if they receive no execute order after their launch order, they were supposed to come back if it was a false alarm in other case. But what what I found was there was no logs, and with for a lot of different reasons, there was good reason to expect that some of those planes would go on to target and the war would be on. That was just one of the things I found. The other thing, very notable, which is a big secret, was that the president had, Eisenhower, had in fact authorized Singh Pak and other theater commanders who had control of nuclear weapons to use their weapons without an order from the president. If communications were out, or if the president were incapacitated, or there just wasn't time for it, in their opinion, they were authorized. In fact, this was a big secret from the American public, although one might well have thought that it should be known to the Russians to deter them from attacking Washington, because that would not paralyze our retaliation. Nevertheless, it looked so dangerous to the layman, that is, the citizens, that the president, that the administration has never really, to this day, admitted that to the public. And to some degree, of course, it remains the case. No nuclear state, I think, has allowed the possibility that a single bomb on their capital or their commanders would paralyze their retaliatory capability. So they have almost surely all delegated that under some circumstances to others. We know that's true of Russia, and they have come to announce it in recent years under Putin for deterrent purpose, but scaring some people with their so-called dead hand system, which assures retaliation if we hit their command and control. Well, that got me into the question of the war plans, which were to be executed in this case. I was perhaps the first civilian who had seen all the nuclear war plans in the Pacific. And on the basis of that and great discrepancies I discovered, I was later given the job under the Kennedy administration of revising those plans, which, you know, were even more insane than the current existing plans, which are a danger to all humanity. And the idea was to make them somewhat less dangerous. I failed in that, although, and everybody else did. That's not, wasn't a an individual failure by me. President after president has tried to revise those plans and run into bureaucratic service resistance from the Air Force and the Navy. The Army no longer controls significant nuclear weapons, if any. But they don't want their plans changed, and they're able to slow walk or just ignore orders from the president. And usually by the end of his term, he has discovered that no directives to this effect have been carried out in practice. That was true for Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Carter, you know, everyone that came along, Ford, throughout the Cold War, and undoubtedly remains true to a considerable extent right now. So that's how I got into it, and that's some of the things I found, which are described in some detail in my book, The Doomsday Machine.
What did you find out about the risks in terms of accidents or false alarms or weapons management? I mean, over the years, we've come close, haven't we?
Yes, there have been numerous, very frequent, small false alarms. Somebody fires off a missile for training or for testing or whatnot, and, you know, raises the question of where is it aimed and so forth. That, you know, is frequent. It's not just the U.S. and Russia now who do that. But most of those get screened out fairly quickly as not being indicative of attack. But a number of them have gone very far in terms of a growing belief higher and higher in the hierarchy that there is an attack going on. And that has reached the highest levels on several occasions in this country and in Russia. Even after the Cold War, Yeltsin, president of Russia at that time in 1995, was informed that an attack was on the way, possibly to Moscow or possibly to cut off communications from a Trident submarine. It turned out to be a flight for weather by the Norwegians, of which the lower levels of the Defense Department in Russia had been informed, but they hadn't passed it on to the top warning levels. And so Yeltsin was informed of this and was prepared to send his forces off, which, by the way, would have been insane. It would have led to the death of nearly all humans. Had he done that, we wouldn't be here. And that was true of these other false alarms as well. But it was insane in the way that we're insane ourselves right now. We're prepared to go on electronic warning to launch our forces. They're only targets of the ICBMs, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are vulnerable and have to be used before they're hit on the ground, use them or lose them. So there's a great incentive to get them off in response to warning. And that has been contemplated, as I say, a number of times. Now, actually, their targets can only be fixed targets in Russia or China, somewhere like that, or North Vietnam, or North Korea, for that matter. And they can't be the submarines, which alone, in Russia's case, can devastate the United States and cause nuclear winter and kill nearly everyone. So the effect of hitting their intercontinental ballistic missiles in Russia by our ICBMs or their command and control will in no way reduce the world-destroying damage of the Russian attack. If there's an attack in a large form, you know, using much of their forces, even a fraction of their forces, humanity is gone. Not entirely, but about 98 or 99% of it. Probably there won't be full extinction, but there will be close to extinction because of the smoke from burning cities that is lofted into the stratosphere where it doesn't rain out, covers the globe, and cuts out 70% of the sunlight, killing all the harvests for a decade or more, freezing rivers, lakes, ice age conditions on the surface of the earth, but in particular, ending the food supply for humans and other animals that depend on vegetation. So it's a doomsday machine that both sides have, and as I've described it, because of the vulnerability of the ICBMs in particular, and the vulnerability of command and control. They're worried about being destroyed. The heads of state before they get a chance to destroy the world by pressing their button. So they're worried about that. That again leads to launch on warning. In short, by mistakes, miscalculations, false readings like the one in Hawaii a year or so ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, which led to a false alert in Hawaii. Well, alarms like that at the highest level, which have occurred, have the ability to destroy complex life on Earth. And that should not be the case. Doomsday machines can't be justified on any remote grounds, I should say, using them and having them and exercising them and having them on hair trigger alert creates a real risk of their going off, even if no one actually wants that to happen. And that's a risk humanity should not be living with, but it is.
Why did you title your book The Doomsday Machine?
What was not known until 1983, which was 40 years into the nuclear era, but it was almost 40 years ago. What that revealed was what I described, the smoke effects, which had not been looked at earlier, which doomed humanity, and not just civilization, as, by the way, climate change threatens and pretty well establishes that if we go on with present policies on burning fossil fuels, most civilization that we know it will be gone, with whether it's in 30 or 50 or even 100 years, it will be gone. The coastal cities will go a lot sooner than that. The nuclear weapon is not as certain to go on. It's just that if we continue policies as we have, rebuilding doomsday machines in Russia and the U.S. and smaller doomsday machines in the other countries, Pakistan and India, for example, would not doom everybody if they went to war now, because their weapons are too small and too few. They have only atomic weapons of the kinds that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And those weapons are now the triggers for modern thermonuclear weapons, which could be 1,000 times more powerful, have been. But in fact, Putin has reportedly put to sea a drone torpedo with at least a 2 million ton, hundreds and hundreds of times more than Nagasaki. So they're spending trillions of dollars, 1.7 trillion in our case as a minimum, over 30 years to rebuild these doomsday machines, which should not exist, even if a number of countries maintained deterrent forces like those of Britain or France. Under 200 warheads, close to 100 warheads. We have 4,000 operational, as does Russia, and many more that could be used on the shelf, by the way. But it takes only a couple hundred of those to cause nuclear winter. The British and French might be able to do it. They're right on the edge. The Chinese can probably do it. They have about 300 weapons altogether. As I say, we have more than 10 times more than that, which is entirely unjustifiable.
Is it realistic to seek the elimination of these doomsday machines and, in fact, of all nuclear weapons?
Well, those are two different things. It'll be quite a while, I think, a long time, before countries like Israel and possibly even England and France or China would think of giving up all of their deterrent capability. As China, for example, which has been under threat from both Russia and the U.S. for decades, and I don't think they have an intention of giving up all of their nuclear weapons, although they have followed a relatively sane policy in the nuclear era of having only enough weapons to constitute a strong deterrent to attack, but not enough to pretend to be able to disarm any of their enemies or to strike first. So they're actually safer than we are, because we're not going to have a false alarm from Russia, from China, as we have, by the way, for Russia, that 500 missiles are on their way to the U.S. We know they don't have 500 missiles. And an alarm like that is going to be interpreted as false, or even 100. They don't have 100 ICBMs, I believe. A lot of their missiles are shorter range and aimed at China, or conceivably India, not the U.S. They're in a much safer position while having very strong deterrence against attack themselves. If we were to go down to the level of China or below that, which would be good, I would say each of these countries has more weapons than they really need for deterrence, even, you know, conservatively justified. The possible exception to that, ironically, is North Korea, which certainly can't cause nuclear winter, but actually, at the most, they have some 60 atomic warheads, A-bombs, the kind that are the triggers for thermonuclear weapons, which they almost surely don't have. Now, they had it one test a year or so ago before they stopped testing at a moratorium that was larger than their early ones, in which they claimed was an H-bomb test. Our intelligence was dubious about that, and H-bombs do take quite a few tests to really assure that they work. But I noticed just this last week they have upped the yield in their estimate of that test considerably. It could now have been about 250 kilotons, which is 20 times Nagasaki and could very well be an H-bomb. The reason some of this matters is, that, very much so, is that if we abandon the test moratorium, essentially, on testing, we have not ratified the comprehensive test ban. I don't think Russia has either, but certainly we have not ratified, and several other countries have not ratified it, but we have been observing it, basically, and it does allow for inspections on both sides if there are suspicions. Today, I read now as we speak that there is a real possibility, it's in the New York Times today, I guess, that the U.S. will abandon the test treaty and the moratorium. We'll go back to testing. That's the latest news. To call that good news would be only ironic, but a little bit too dark. Terrible news. If other countries resume testing, then India and Pakistan will get thermonuclear weapons within a year or two, and North Korea could too if they resume testing, which under this administration would be very subject to John Bolton's demand as national security assistant that the president resume attack North Korea and essentially destroy it. If we wouldn't do that to India and Pakistan. If they get H-bombs, then a war between India and Pakistan would create enough smoke to kill not just the 2 billion people who would starve as a result of an India-Pakistan war now, and I say that, you know, that's obviously an intolerable risk for the world right now. If they get H-bombs and substitute those for their more than 100 each weapons so far, then a war between India and Pakistan would kill, starve within a year, not 2 billion people, but 7 billion people, just like us. There'd be two more doomsday machines in the world, again, on hair trigger. And that's so our policy of maintaining that is just a clear encouragement to India and Pakistan to go the same route. And all that it takes, basically, is for us to abandon the nuclear test ban treaty, and just as Trump has abandoned the Iran agreement, the Paris agreement, and the intermediate range missile test agreement. So the word in the story today is John Bolton has long wanted exactly that, to clear the decks of any arms control agreement, have have an unrestricted arms race, which, as Trump says, we will win, and which will preserve his risk, will not in any way diminish the risk and may increase it, of the doomsday machines going off.
Trump administration has announced, and I think it might have gone back to Obama, that they want to spend $1.5 trillion over the next decade to beef up the nuclear arsenal.
Obama, and he's increased it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's certainly scary. Dan Ellsberg, before we let you go, tell us what's been the reception that your book has received since it came out at the end of 2017?
Well, much better than other publishers expected. 18 publishers rejected this book on the grounds that they couldn't sell it, that it was not commercial. And finally, Bloomsbury picked it up. And started by printing, I think, 17,000, something like that. Well, they've had a number of printings in the last 2 years since the paperback was out, and they sold, well, more than 40,000. So they sold over 40,000. I don't know the latest figures, and it's in a few other countries. Banned in the Ukraine, by the way. I find odd reasons, but it is in Russia and Japan. And I wish it were in England. I wish it were in Germany and France, but haven't found any publishers willing to translate it yet. So that's more than was expected for a new book on nuclear war, but is far from being a bestseller. Got very good reviews, but I wish it had been read by more people and have to let them know what the world is we're living in. There is a plan, I think, to get it to members of Congress.
We've been talking to Dan Ellsberg, first about Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning, and the last segment of our show about his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear Planner. Dan, you were awarded the Olof Palme Prize for profound humanism and exceptional moral courage. They certainly gave it to the right man. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.